Victor and Lois are siblings who were both diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. Lois lives and works in London, and Hector is a student living in Vienna. In their weekly podcast, Anxiety Calling, they'll be talking about different aspects of living with generalized anxiety disorder and how they get by in day-to-day life.
Welcome to episode 17 of Anxiety Calling. I'm Hector.
And I'm Lois. And this week we're going to be talking about self-medicating and anxiety.
Yeah. And so I'd like to start with a trigger warning because we will be talking about alcohol. We'll be talking about drugs. We'll be talking about
nicotine,
medication. And also from the start, I'd like to say we don't advise. What we're going to talk about is just our own experiences of what things we did. We don't advise anybody to try to treat symptoms of anxiety or panic with, to go into self-medication.
Yeah.
Because
medication is an absolute viable option to help with symptoms of anxiety, but obviously with a prescription from a doctor and with consultation with a doctor. Obviously.
Yes, consultation is the most important thing. So I know from my part, especially at the very beginning before I was diagnosed with suffering from a panic disorder, which was before my anxiety disorder, I did definitely self-medicate with alcohol. I'm not sure if I even knew that's what I was doing exactly, but I did sort of, I don't know, I was like in a bar or at a party or something. I just felt super anxious and nervous, and I just noticed that, of course, alcohol has a tranquilizing, calming effect, and I did do this. And the same also counts for nicotine. I think I used to smoke a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't do that so much anymore. I think it is known, that people do definitely, alcohol is probably the number one.
Yeah, from what I've heard, drug. The most common form of self-medication that people do for anxiety is drinking alcohol, because it's a legal sedative, you know? There are legal sedatives it's a legal sedative that you don't need a prescription for. You don't need to go to a doctor. It's sort of limitless, you know, it's everywhere. You can get it anywhere as long as you're like old enough, obviously.
And it's socially acceptable.
It's also socially acceptable. So it's kind of, it's a very easy one to turn to because it's, you know, it's very accessible to people. So that is the most common substance to turn to. I think probably the most constant thing for me has always been nicotine.
Mm.
It was, and it's always been kind of on and off. I've gone through sometimes phases of a year. It's usually about a year that I'll stop for like a whole year sometimes, and then I will take it up again. And usually the trigger for me taking up smoking again is some kind of traumatic experience or some like extremely anxious time. Classic triggers would have been breakups.
Same.
Would then start me smoking again, or I remember when I was trying to finish university, I had like one last exam and I was so afraid I was going to fail. And I was having trouble in my relationship at the time as well. And then I just started smoking again, and I didn't stop for a long time. And then I managed to stop again, and I stopped for a couple of months, but then I moved to London and I started smoking the Juul, so like an e-cigarette.
Mm.
And I'm probably more addicted to the e-cigarette than I ever was to real cigarettes.
Yeah, I mean, for me, they're also phase, but I think also it's the case for me that if I have emotional troubles, my first impulse is usually have a beer and a cigarette, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing, that's how I started smoking again. I remember, like, because I said it was on and off all the time from the age 15 two now. And sometimes it'd be like significant pauses for like maybe a year, sometimes longer. But like when it happened last time, I remember just calling my best friend and being like, having a meltdown on the phone. She's like, okay, just tell me what you want me to get you and I will come to your place and bring it to you. And then I said, okay, I need a packet of cigarettes, the specific cigarettes that I always smoked, and I need a beer. And then she came around with a beer and the packet of cigarettes, and I just chain smoked for like five cigarettes. And then I just couldn't, yeah. I didn't get off them for ages after that.
Yeah. I mean, and so this would be like an example in the context of anxiety or panic where, I mean, the interesting thing is that alcohol and nicotine, as an example, or marijuana and other drugs actually can also increase symptoms of anxiety or panic. So it's a bit of a...
It's a hard thing. Was it in the moment? It can suppress it. Like with nicotine, yeah. The thing is, it is so calming, you know, especially when I'm trying to gather my thoughts. It yeah. can be so calming. And then I'm calm for a bit. But in the long run...
It's
bad for your body, which in turn obviously is then also bad. So it's bad for your health, that's also bad for your mind. And the addiction is the problem as well. Like if I misplace my freaking e-cigarette, I lose my mind. Like I can't just relax until I found it. I will have a complete meltdown until I found it, and then I'm okay again. And that again is just a clear sign that it's not good, you know.
I mean I have had moments when I just 3 a.m just literally walk out of my apartment and find a place. I mean, of course that doesn't work in Vienna because everything's always closed, but especially now. But when I was living in Berlin, you could find anything everywhere.
And you can smoke in so many bars in Berlin still.
Yeah, true. And I mean, yeah, I'd go out at 3 a.m. because I just suddenly realized I had to smoke. I mean, that would be one thing that I would come straight to mind for me in the context of self-medication. What I also was thinking about before, so when I was thinking about what I want to talk about today, I also thought about there are so many things that one tries when you have a panic disorder or an anxiety disorder to help. And you know, I tried so many things. I tried CBD tablets and oil. I tried valerian. I tried what are the other calmings, lavender, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I think the frustrating thing is, you know, there's always someone you know who says, okay, I tried this and it made me super calm. Yeah. And you try them, and for me the problem was, I did try them, and I think they probably do help a bit, but of course if you're having like massive anxiety or massive panic, taking a lavender tablet won't take the edge off quickly enough.
The end is nigh. Heed my warning, for I am Jib, the chosen one, chosen to disclaim in the name of the Caterpillar Man, who so spoketh. Those that which have the podcast by the name of Anxiety Calleth are not prophets of the health of the mind. Thus that which of what they taketh is nothing more than the idle sentiment of a youth which has lost its way, for their quest is to raise awareness and help end the stigma of mental illness. Lock up your hamsters!
Thank you so much for listening. This message was brought to you by Jib, the disclaimer dude.
Yeah, even Valium for me didn't feel like it was enough. I managed to get a doctor here to prescribe me Valium. It wasn't like for a long period of time or anything. It was just a couple of tablets for a specific reason that I need, because I had a specific doctor's appointment coming up that I knew was going to be very, very hard for me. And I explained the situation to my GP, and he agreed to prescribe me, I think, 4 Valium tablets to kind of get me in a more calmer state of mind leading up to the appointment, which was great, obviously, because it was very helpful to me at the time. However, I was taking Valium and I couldn't feel any difference. There didn't seem to be, I couldn't feel, and I still felt incredibly anxious about the appointment that was coming up. And I wasn't, I mean, because I'd watched people take Valium before and they seemed really chill to me, and they seemed like, and everyone had told me, oh, this is, it's fine. It'll really make you super chill. But I felt still as anxious as before. However, from everyone else's perspective who witnessed me on Valium, they said I was very chill in comparison to how I usually am. And like I was talking to my best friend on the phone, and I was like saying to her, like, I'm really worried because I still feel incredibly anxious, and I have this appointment coming up, and I'm really worried it's going to be terrible. And she said to me, like, I know you think it's not working, but to me, you sound like someone who lives in California. Like, you just sound so relaxed right now. Even though what you're saying is that you are feeling anxious, you sound a lot more relaxed than you usually are. So it was definitely working. But I was expecting it to work in such a way that I would like feel kind of happy and like contented and not as anxious as I usually am. But I think that's not how it works. I think it does calm you down, and it does make you maybe not react as strongly as you would to things, but the feeling is still there. The fear is still there.
Yeah, I mean, okay, but that would be like an example of prescribed medication. I mean, we can talk about that anyway, actually, I think. I mean, I did try prescribed medication, so benzodiazepine, no, lorazepam that I took. I'm not sure what it's called in England, but
I think that is Valium.
Okay, well, the one that
called,
I
think it was called benzo something here as well, but like the Valium is a brand name, I think.
Well, benzodiazepines are basically benzodiazepines are generally sedatives. Benzodiazepines are sedatives. And for a doctor, when I was like very suffering strongly from panic attacks, I did get a couple of these benzodiazepines. It was lorazepam, which is, and the brand name in Germany was Tavor.
Tavor.
And so it's a medication which is used for different sorts of things. I have to say, so I had a couple of these if I have a panic attack. And the disturbing thing for me was, I realized, so I stopped taking them, was that, the one thing is they're very addictive because they're super effective. What you do is you put it on your tongue and it melts. And within seconds, you're completely calm. You just don't feel.
I didn't even have that with Tavor. I tried Tavor anything. In Munich. It did not have that effect on me.
You take half of one or a whole one?
A whole one.
Okay. Well, with me, it had the effect that it just knocks you out instantly. And the problem was, for me, I realized later that obviously when you're having a panic attack, it's like it's a feeling which is getting stronger and stronger. It sort of pinnacles at some point and then it goes down. And I noticed that if I cut that off in the middle with lorazepam, it really confused me because it sort of, I mean, that's the point of the drug, obviously, is that it's supposed to break this this moment. But for me, it was somehow more confusing to break that moment. And then after that, and then it lasts for like 6 hours, you're just completely you're completely calm, and it's really hard to explain, but it's not just calm in a good kind of way, it's just like you don't even register
it's
calmness.
Like you're numb.
Yeah, it's like you're not, you know, it's just completely yeah, it's like you're unconscious in a kind of way, but you're not.
Yeah.
And the problem was with me then, as soon as that wore off, I just had like a terrible depression. And so I stopped taking them because I noticed, for me at least, and I'm not saying anybody should not take medication that they've spoken to the doctor about and have decided is effective and makes sense to, especially if you're like in a situation which might actually cause trauma, to take it. But yeah, for me, it was more, I couldn't face the depression afterwards. So I just went through the panic.
That's interesting. So sedatives kind of made you feel depressed.
Yeah, I mean, lots of things, lots of substances that have an effect have this. I mean, if I drink a lot of alcohol the next day,
yeah, so
I'm depressed.
Kind of, you're also kind of coming down from that. So that is that's true.
Yep, and other drugs also have had that effect on me, and so yeah, I mean, I decided eventually not to take them anymore because it was also, but I think also a part of me was just really scared of getting addicted because benzodiazepines are very addictive because they're so effective. And
that's the thing, they are very, very reluctant to prescribe because, like, my thing has always been because we mentioned this briefly in the last episode that I react well to sedatives. And like they, I mean, first of the trouble with that is on one hand, it takes quite a lot to sedate me is one thing I have. And I don't know why that is, but like, for instance, like I said, Tavor didn't really have much of an effect on me. And here when I was taking Valium, and like I said, it wasn't much, it wasn't for a long time. It was like 4 days. It didn't seem to have an effect on me. So you have to go, I have to take like very strong stuff for it to be, I may have an effect. And what I did one time take, but this was not prescribed to me. I got it from somebody.
So that would be self-medication again. And we're back on track.
We're back on track to self-medication here. So prescription drugs can be obtained without a prescription, obviously.
Which we don't advise.
It is illegal. Don't do that. I knew somebody who was, who I knew had Xanax. I don't know if, honestly, I'm not even sure if this person, I don't think they had a prescription. I don't think they did. I think they just had it because they had a dealer who had Xanax. And so they had that, and I was going through some stuff and I took it, and I have never felt so relaxed in my life. It was very, it was, and but to the point where it was interesting what you were saying, because it was kind of like you were awake, but you were so sedated that you almost didn't really experience anything happening. So in this particular instance, I had to travel, and traveling makes me very anxious. And it was a very, the whole situation and in which this was happening was like a very stressful, it was a very stressful scenario. And I was very stressed about having to travel, and I was very stressed about the circumstances under which this was happening. And so I took the Xanax, and basically I don't remember traveling to the airport or going through security. I basically woke up again. Like I was fully present the whole time, but I basically snapped out of it and woke up just before getting on the plane. And so hours of traveling all the way to the airport, going through security, which does stress me out immensely, was all went by like in a daze without me even experiencing it. So that was pretty awesome, if I'm being honest. But that's like, again, why it's so addictive. I think that my position has always been, if I could just get a doctor to prescribe me Xanax, for instance, like very strong Valium, or you know, preferably Xanax, for me to just use when I actually needed it, that would be my ideal scenario. But they very rightfully so don't just hand it out, because it is very addictive. And the chances of me, basically the threshold becoming smaller and smaller, like, okay, with any stressful situation, just deciding to opt for Xanax would just be probably too hard to resist.
Like one does with cigarettes or alcohol. That's maybe one of the reasons why it's socially acceptable, because it's a, you know, a drug which is, I mean, and if we're honest, it is a drug.
It is a drug.
Which is easy to, I mean, I know my limits, you know, I know what the effect will be, and I know what different kinds of alcohol, you know, and I mean, of course, it's also part of, because you grew up with it, and so it's much easier to understand.
Years of experience. And that's the thing, like, I think we had a very different experience, say, to the Americans, because in America, legally, you can't drink until you're 21. So like, yeah, of course, people drink before that secretly or whatever. But we grew up in a country where we could legally drink some alcohol at 16.
Beer and wine, yeah.
Beer and wine at 16. Wine is actually quite strong. It's not that much. And I've had some of my worst
hangovers from wine.
Yeah, wine is the worst. I think my worst hangovers have been from wine, actually. And then at 18, you can, everything's fair game, you know. Oh. But you grow, and I think it's also personally, like, I just think that is
And you're allowed to drink in public here. You're not allowed to drink in public in America, are you? In some places.
Okay, so it's difficult. You can't just drink on the street in most states. That's illegal. Drinking outside, so if there's a restaurant thing, then there has to be like a, it has to be sort of closed off from the street, so it's clear that it's an establishment.
You're
allowed to drink outside. Otherwise, you're only allowed to drink inside. And a lot of bars and stuff, you're not allowed to take kids to, which I think, like, because like here, for instance, you could take your kid to the pub, no problem. Like, nobody cares if there's a toddler running around the pub. No one cares. And in Germany, again, like beer garden, you have kids playing, it's no problem, because they also have things on the menu, obviously, that don't have alcohol in them. But in America,
I remember as a kid, there'd be like even restaurants and bars that you would be in as a kid, and there'd be people smoking inside as well.
As a child, people would be smoking, drinking was really not an issue. I think from my perspective, we, you know, started, let's say we were legally allowed to drink at 16. Obviously, we had some drinks before that too, but we kind of grew up around alcohol and it not being a big taboo.
Yeah.
So we were very, we have years of experience in drinking and like knowing our limits and what kind of alcohol will affect you in what way. And which I think personally, I think that's a good thing, because like, I know that there are certain alcohols I refuse to drink because it's not worth it. And I know that if I go too far, I will throw up. And as I have a fear of throwing up, I know not to cross that threshold.
Yeah.
But just like one or two beers, or like one or two glasses of wine, is just that perfect, is that perfect state of slightly tipsy. My goal is often just to get tipsy, not drunk. I love the tipsy feeling because you're kind of in a good mood and you're feeling relaxed. And I don't usually crave alcohol, but I do when I've had like a breakdown. I've had a breakdown. All I want is a pint of beer.
No, I mean, the same as for me. I mean, if I've had like a rotten day, or even just an exhausting day at work, or or if I've had an emotional issue, and especially now that you can't actually go anywhere, I just, you know, feel like it'd just be really nice to just be sitting somewhere in the bar with a nice person. And drinking a beer.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, of course, these are coping strategies, and they are ingrained in us, and they are part of our society, which is where, like you said before, alcohol is very accepted and part of it. And I mean, of course, there's also a huge industry behind it, but that's not really the point. If I drink because I think, okay, I want to drink, and not because I want to use it as a form of medication. But maybe that's just me
rationalizing it.
It's hard to say.
I really just kind of, because I don't actually drink that much. I think I'm much more addicted to nicotine than I am to alcohol. I bring alcohol into when I've had a hard day and I just really need it, then I will drink. So I do use alcohol very knowingly as either as a sedative, as a legal sedative that is not, that I don't need to get the doctor to prescribe me, or as a social, you know, as to help me with my social skills. And to make me feel less anxious, in particularly in like social situations, because I feel like drinking, because there's drinking to like, because you're stressed and you want to like, you know, just put a damper on the stress. And I think that especially in social situations, that is when I would turn to alcohol, or like to help me deal with my social anxiety, but also, or especially big crowds. I can't bear big crowds, but, you know, get a couple of beers in me and I don't really have such a big issue with it anymore.
I mean, I used to do that much more. I mean, I used to definitely be a sort of, you might call a nervous social drinker. So if I was in a social situation, the first thing I'd do is just like, you know, get two beers inside me as quickly as possible, so that I could just, you know, lose my social anxiety, which I used to have much stronger than I do now. What really helped, because what happened with me was, before I was diagnosed with my panic disorder, it was a phase when I was actually pretty unhealthy. I was drinking a lot, working a lot, smoking a lot. And part of my therapy at the time was that I just, because like I said before, alcohol and nicotine can actually increase symptoms of panic disorder or an anxiety disorder. And so I, from one day to the next, completely quit, which was really hard at first.
Mm. Yeah, I remember you were so, like, you know, basically completely sober.
I was completely sober.
You weren't even having caffeine.
No, I was no caffeine, no alcohol, no sugar, no anything stimulating. I just completely cut off. And the hardest thing to come to terms with, and this is actually quite disturbing if you think about it, the hardest thing for me to come to terms with at that point, so like I said, from one day to the next, I completely stopped drinking alcohol and consuming, well, and, you know, like we said, anything stimulating, for 3 years. And for the first, I think, 6 to 8 months, the hardest thing to come to terms with was how boring it was.
Yes.
And this is actually quite a frightening thought, because then I suddenly thought to myself, is it possible that the only thing that made my life interesting and more exciting was my regular consumption of substances? Mm. And probably it's true in a way, because of course it has an effect obviously on your brain chemistry, and it changes how things are happening around you, and it also can give more a different sort of view onto things. And of course that is what makes it addictive. But the thing, yes, like I said, for the first 8 months or so, my biggest problem was not even the withdrawal from substances was difficult, but that wasn't actually that long. That was only about a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
But the most difficult thing was, first of all, that it was boring.
Mm-hmm.
That I felt bored. And another very difficult thing was actually just being in social situations where you're expected to drink, so just saying, no, I'm not going to drink.
Yeah.
First of all, people don't react that well to that. They don't like it.
They don't like it.
Some feel criticized.
Yeah.
And that was very difficult. And I did actually lose a few friends over the fact that I just was completely, substance free for a long time. That was interesting.
It is, yeah.
But that did really cure my, funnily enough, because I did start going when I was less anxious. Again, I did start going to social events and just not drinking. And I suddenly realized that it is actually possible for me to be in a room with lots of people and not drink anything. And I have to say, this was the thing is, not drinking for 3 years, I was physically actually in really good shape. You know, I was exercising all the time and I had no hangovers. I just, you know, I needed less sleep, and it was actually really good. After 3 years, I did then start to drink occasionally, more responsibly.
Mm.
Of course, there were phases when I started university. It was more, but I think now I don't have the same, it's not like it used to, it's not like it was then. I think I have quite a relatively healthy relationship with substances.
It's interesting for me, because I've witnessed you both ways. I've witnessed sober Hector, like very conscientious about his health, and like going out and like maybe drinking an alcohol-free beer but having a great time, and just like no smoking, no caffeine, nothing.
Hey, when I was in sugar. London, I was like that, wasn't I? I wasn't drinking.
Last time you visited me, you were sober. Me and our other brother were getting a bit twatted, but you were perfectly happy just to watch us get drunk and
I had fun. I had fun
and,
anyway.
And just drink alcohol-free beer. So I know really responsible sober Hector, and I know incredibly irresponsible drunk Hector, who forces me to do things I don't want to do.
What? I never forced you to do anything.
Oh my god, you were, yeah, no, you do, because like I'm like, I think we should go home, like I think it's like it's late. You're like, what? What are you talking about? No, there's still this bar I know that's open. Let's go. Last time we went drinking was that insane night where we in the end decided we had to leave because everyone was escalating so badly that we just made a legger without anyone noticing.
Was that in Vienna?
Yeah. Last time I visited you in Vienna.
It wasn't that bad, though. It was like 3 a.m., I think.
That wasn't that late, but then you wanted to, then we got back to your place and you made pizza and we had to watch something on telly. And I actually went, that's the only time in my life I've ever passed out while there was something on the telly, because I can't sleep if there's something playing. And I just passed out because I was so drunk and I was so tired and it was stupid o'clock in the morning. I've noticed this thing. When you are like partying and having a good time and you are drinking, it's very hard to get you to stop.
No, that is my problem.
That is your problem.
When I get into it, I can, and I think many people have this. It's true. I have probably two extremes. I have like super sensible or I have just completely insane.
Yeah. I mean, no one has managed to convince me to do so many stupid things than you when drunk. You're very persuasive as well.
Yes, because sometimes it's just so much fun. Until the next day.
Exactly. Because I'm always thinking about what's going to happen.
That used to be our bad
next.
Habit. I remember now, it used to be our bad habit that when we met, if we'd go to drink, it just escalated completely.
It escalated unbelievably because I'm an enabler, because I just let you do whatever you want and I don't put my foot down because I'm like, oh, you know, okay, fine. I guess we can do this. And you have no limit.
Don't pretend you didn't have fun.
No, we had the best times. We had the best times, but like often at the very end of it, I always felt like we should have just stopped hours ago. Like that time we were stuck in your office until the trains were running again because it was so late, the trains weren't even running.
I don't even know where we were before that. How did we end up in the office?
You went to see a play of mine.
Ah, yeah.
And you went to see my play and then we drank for ages in the theater and then we were drinking at Hauptbahnhof and then at Cafe Cosmos and then everything was shut and then you had the keys to your office, which was also there.
Oh yeah.
And so we went up to your office.
But didn't we, after the office and after your friend left, also then go to Hauptbahnhof and have another beer?
We had another beer and I think we had breakfast with the beer and then we went home.
Yeah, that was disgusting.
It was a horrendous night. And we did that every time we hung out together.
Yeah. Every time. It is true, there is a dark side to me.
And at the beginning of it, I would always say, okay, Hector, we're going to have one drink. Okay. And then like...
Yeah, but I always said, yeah.
And you would say, oh yeah, one drink. And then at like 3 a.m. at 3 a.m. it was like 20 drinks later at least. And we were somewhere ridiculous.
Yeah, that was a bit weird.
A lot of substance abuse, you know, smoking too much, drinking too much, partying too much,
taking drugs
is often, it's just a way of distracting yourself from the anxiety as well. It's not just in the sense that, you know, yes, alcohol is a sedative, which does help with anxiety. So like when you've had a meltdown, yes, having a glass of wine is, you know, can be spot on because it does just calm you down. I would recommend stopping after that one glass though, but you know, that is often hard to do. But I think often a sort of very excessive lifestyle is something that you kind of use to distract yourself from your mental health because you're either recovering from a night out or you're on a night out, you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, it goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable. That's not a sustainable lifestyle. And I think that, you know, and there's so many things out there that you can, that, you know, are appealing. For instance, for the lack of energy that you feel because of your anxiety, you tend to feel very exhausted. Classic one would be obviously caffeine. But if you want to go even more hardcore, something like cocaine, for instance, as a way of staying alert, as a way of being able to, you know, work properly, as a way of being able to party for longer, cocaine is a typical option. Or something like ecstasy, because, you know, obviously it makes you very, very, very happy. The trouble is coming down from that. I've never even tried any of these so I've never had chemical drugs like ecstasy because I'm too afraid of how I will feel when I come down from it. Like, as I'm the trouble is I have so little serotonin and dopamine bobbing about my brain as it is, and I'm afraid of using that up. You know, I need it, you know, What little?
But it is, I mean, definitely a side effect. I mean, I know people who have this trouble that it's sort of it's like a cycle from one party, and then after the party comes the depression, then the next party. And the distraction thing you said is absolutely true, because obviously if you're out with people and you're having a good time, you're not going to be thinking about the anxious, the things that make you anxious about, I don't know, normal day-to-day life or more philosophical existential stuff.
And I feel like that's why some people don't want to stop. It's because like they feel great while they're, you know, having that fun. And that's why, and they don't want to stop, because if they stop, then they'll be back with their anxiety.
I mean, I think I did definitely, before I had my like real nervous breakdown, I was probably in a phase like that. I did party an awful lot.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, seeking sensations everywhere. And that's what I mean when I said that when I completely stopped for 3 years, the most difficult thing at first was like the boredom of it, and the amount of time that you have, because time just goes much slower in that sense. And
I feel like me was the other way around. I feel like when I got diagnosed, that's when I really escalated in that regard. Okay. That maybe I was then
the other way around. Yeah.
With you, it was the other way around, because you, but I also wasn't partying excessively before I got diagnosed.
Yeah.
Everything was kind of like regular, I would say. I didn't go out excessively, I didn't drink excessively. I was probably smoking at the time. Yeah, I was definitely smoking at the time. But after I got diagnosed, that's when I kind of really escalated, and I started, I did drink a lot more, smoked a lot more. I was smoking marijuana several times a week. Mm. Like everything that like could distract me from what I had just basically found out about myself. It was kind of like, I don't know what it was, but something kind of flipped in me when I found that out. And I just wanted to, I don't know, I just completely broke out and just like was and I was like, yeah, and I was rarely alone. I think I didn't want to be alone for a second
with
myself.
I think it's an interesting example, because it can go both ways. I think, I mean, like I said, for me it was just the complete opposite. I was really, I think, very unhealthy before I got my diagnosis, and I think it was maybe even a wake-up call in a way, because I think within my case it was also causing a lot of anxiety, because obviously I was always super tired or hungover. And I mean, it is a fact, even now, I mean, it doesn't happen often, but if I do drink too much, then if I'm hungover, I'm much more prone to depression, anxiety, even panic, because I'm physically in bad shape. I haven't slept well. And also because my serotonin level has obviously been depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is a huge factor in both ways. I think people use it to combat anxiety, but I think it does also cause, and for me, I notice now that I'm 30, so I got more healthy, I developed a more healthy relationship to substances, I think. I do know what I'm doing now, which is good, because when I'm in my early 20s, I mean, you know, most people in their early 20s are crazy, or lots of people, not most people, but lots of people are, in the sense that I was just doing a lot of unhealthy things. And but I did have a lot of fun. I do have to say that as well.
Yeah, it's the thing. I sort of think a part of me probably felt so hard done by. I hadn't had a very unhealthy lifestyle. I exercised regularly. I had a, you know, my diet was like perfect as far as I was concerned. I was like, you know, I had a very healthy lifestyle. I wasn't drinking. I barely drank. I rarely, like, I, you know, obviously as a teenager, I'd had my fair share of, like, you know, binge drinking, and I, you know, had experimented with marijuana as well when I was a teenager. But for the most part in my early 20s, I had evened out to the point of having like a really, really, really like healthy, because I also had, you know, orthorexia. So like, it was a very healthy lifestyle. I mean, okay, it was not necessarily in my mind healthy, but like physically it was very healthy. And so I was really, when I then had that, and I was kind of like, I felt so hard done by, you know. And then I was kind of like, why did I do all that? Like, I, one of my goals was that I wanted to be balanced, and I knew that, you know, certain substances can affect your brain in a way that will lead to you having, you know, mental illnesses. And I was kind of like, how did this happen to me? Like, how could I have a mental illness even though I felt like I was doing everything right? And so at that point I felt like, well, nothing matters. It doesn't matter. Like, anything, well, it'll happen to you either way. So I, you know, then thought, okay, well, in that case, I'm, you know, going to be irresponsible now. And had a bit of a self-destructive phase there, though, for sure.
Well, I think the feeling hard done by thing, I had that as well. I think that happens either way. I felt extremely hard done by that I have this condition. And I also felt, like I said at the beginning, I felt sort of, I felt hard done by, because I mean, I did still meet people, and I felt, because what I decided to do was just not drink or smoke or do anything anymore. And I also felt hard done by, because I couldn't, I felt like, yes, I couldn't do those things anymore, escalate or just, you know, get drunk, or because I knew that it would have a negative effect on my anxiety and my panic. And I felt very hard done by. I think either way you'll feel hard done by if you are suffering from a panic disorder or an anxiety disorder.
I think after I got diagnosed, I was kind of like chasing after, I don't know, something, sensation, I guess. Chasing after anything that would like make me feel happy or make me forget that, forget the anxiety, I guess. And so did a lot of stuff for a bit, and then but again, then I did reduce alcohol for sure very quick. I mean, not long, I didn't go on for that long, like just maybe a couple of years of me kind of escalating a bit, and then I kind of calmed down again and drank a lot less. I did quit smoking for quite a while, but you know, started again. And I go kind of through phases, I feel like, because then like I had a long phase of not really drinking much. Then I went through a breakup and was like kind of back on top of this sort of lifestyle of being very like going out a lot, drinking a lot more, smoking a lot more, and just kind of again, like seeking sensation, I guess.
And that's a classic, you know, reaction. That for most people, you know, whether they have anxiety or not.
Yeah, for sure. I think one interesting one for me is actually marijuana, because like I said, I mentioned this before in our first episode actually, that after I got diagnosed, I did smoke quite a lot of weed. Because, you know, I knew somebody who had anxiety and he swore by it. He said it was a really good way to it was a really good way to help it. And it did for a time. It really did, actually. It was good in that sense. It it's like a sedative. It just, it did chill me out a lot. But again, it depends on what kind you use. Like there's so many different types. You want to be careful at what type you smoke, which is another reason
why. The psychedelic one.
Exactly. Which is why I think it should be, legalized. You should be able to go to a shop and say, this is the specific thing I'm looking for. I'm just looking for something. If you're looking for one that expands your mind, great. If you're looking for one that is just supposed to calm you down, also great. And like that would be, if I did have access to it, I probably would sometimes smoke marijuana, just the one, like specific types that are like for, to help me relax. That would be great. But you don't necessarily always know what you're going to get, you know, what someone has. And so like, it's not just one, it's like, if you have a beer, you're kind of sure it's going to have a certain effect on you. You might not like the taste, but it will have pretty much the same effect on you, right? Mm. Always. With marijuana, you don't know if it's going to be one that's going to make you paranoid or if it's going to be one that just chills you out. So that wasn't like a good one. And because it's not legal, you kind of, people just sort of take what they can get. And also you don't get the same, I've never met someone who like knew like loads about it. Some people know a lot about what type to take and what ones are the best ones and so on. And like, if you had, they have those in some states in America where you have like actual shops, you just go there. And I think they have this in Holland 2, where you can like actually just like discuss what you exactly you're looking for, and then they'll give you what you're looking for.
Mm.
Like that seems ideal to me. But yeah, I did do that for a bit. And there were ups and downs to that for sure. But it can sometimes, you know, make me a bit paranoid. And like now it's like, and that's so annoying. Like for a time it really helped, but now I feel like every time I've smoked pot, every time I think I'm going to die.
Well, with me, I mean, I haven't smoked it for 11 years, I think.
Wow, that's long.
Because when I was like 17 or 18, I had a group of friends who did smoke a lot. And then for a phase, I did smoke quite a lot. And with me, it did have a more of a unsettling effect than a settling effect. Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, like I said, you know, the different people, you know, react differently to lots of different stuff. And that's why people experiment and find things that work for them. Yeah, so like I said, I it doesn't really work for me in a way, because it just makes me feel queasy and or paranoid. I did have a couple of, when I was 17, which was a long time ago, 13 years ago, 14 years ago, I had very uncomfortable experiences with it. So then I just, you know, I just stopped. I thought, okay, this is not my gig.
I just get completely incapacitated. Like I feel ill and then I'm just like lying there in a daze and I can't like move and I have all these weird sensations, and then I'm really convinced that I'm going to die for about an hour and then I'm fine again. But like that's not like, that's just sad when you smoke pot to relax yourself and you think you're going to die for an hour. That's just terrible.
That's not good.
No. Yeah. So no, that's kind of, that's another thing that makes me a bit, I was very anxious about eating marijuana for a long time. I just didn't want to do it because I was too scared of the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, for me, after the experiences I had and how extreme my panic and anxiety disorder were, and that is why I think at the time, for a long time, I stopped consuming any kind of substances. And I still actually don't take caffeine, because caffeine is, for example, one which is heavily indicated, caffeine and sugar in anxiety.
They definitely contribute to anxiety, because it's like, I mean, it makes
sense. So now I think it has, that did definitely change my life in the sense of consuming substances. And still, like, it's been a long time now, actually, it's 7 years, 8 years. It did change. And so now I am actually very careful. The only thing that does occasionally happen is that I get a little bit too drunk. But yeah, you know,
the problem is that these drugs, whether it's caffeine, whether it's alcohol, whatever, they have been proven to affect your sleep. And yes, as we discussed in the last episode, if your sleep is affected and you're not getting the kind of sleep you need, then that will increase your anxiety. So it's kind of like, it's all connected, and it's just like it isn't the answer. Drinking is not the answer for sure, because yes, it feels like, yes, it will chill you out because it's a sedative, but the sleep that you're getting on alcohol is not the same as what you would get when you're sober. And so it's not actually, although you might feel like you're helping yourself sleep, it's not exactly the sleep you need, which is the same with sleeping pills, as we also discussed in the last one, is that I'm very partial to sleeping pills because, again, like, I do react well to sedatives.
I think the thing is, as human beings, you know, and as in the modern times we live in, we do have possibilities, whether it's legal drugs or prescribed drugs or alcohol, or I think we have possibilities to combat or affect or short-term, change something short-term, what's going on. And I think it's very hard to decide not to. I mean, people say it's an easy way out. And I don't 100% agree. I think there are times when the easy way out is the best option. And I'm not saying to take drugs. I'm saying if you're in a very bad state, I think medication can be the right answer if it is carefully taken and, you know, talked about with your doctor. But I think in the case of things, we are talking about self-medication now, so I'll stick with that maybe, and not with prescribed things. But I think I really understand, and I experienced it myself, that sometimes you just really want a quick and easy way out of some turmoil.
Yeah. I think it's also important not to judge yourself too harshly, but also not to judge if if you know someone who has anxiety, who has a tendency to, turn to the bottle. Like, if you don't suffer from anxiety, it's hard to understand how desperate you get.
Or depression.
How desperate you get to feel some kind of relief from that.
Yeah.
And if all it takes is, a drink, which is all around you and so easily accessible and legal, it's very, very tempting to do that.
Yeah, and tempting to do that continuously. And this is something that is very hard to understand, because when you are suffering from strong anxiety or panic or depression, what you said, you just, you're clutching at straws. You do anything. Sometimes there are situations where I would literally do anything to make it stop.
Yeah. I think also a thing that you have to keep in mind is, I can't speak for everyone, but a lot of people I know with anxiety do tend to have quite addictive personalities.
Mm.
And I think that, again, I think it's because of this desperation to find some kind of relief. And so people who I know with anxiety, myself included, have a tendency to get addicted to things, whether it's substances or it can be people, it can be a certain activity, it can be going to the gym, you can get be addicted to that. You can be addicted to, anything, a TV show, specific foods, just things that give you some sense of relief or some sense of enjoyment.
Or distraction.
These are things that you long for them so much that you kind of, when you find something that gives you that outlet, it's hard not to get addicted. And so that's like another thing. And the thing with alcohol is, we're taking alcohol as an example now, is that it's also physically addictive,
It is, yeah.
You might become addicted because of the outlet that you get and also the relief you feel, but then it is also physically addictive. So then you are physically addicted to it. And then it's it's a terrible cycle. And then by that point, after using it multiple times in order to combat your anxiety, you have found yourself physically addicted to it. And
that is one thing that I did notice about, so having myself suffered from anxiety, depression, panic. I think I'm much less judgmental towards people who self-medicate, take substances, drink lots of alcohol, because, like I said before, it's, like we said before, you would do anything for it to stop sometimes. There is a critic, people say, it's the easy way out and it's just willpower. You just need willpower.
That you're somehow weak if you give in to the temptation. But you also get accused of being weak if you take meds. Like, it's like that people will judge you for anything, whether it's you're taking antidepressants or whatever it is. Like, people will judge you for anything you do. And that's the thing. Like, if you don't want to take, if you think people are weak for taking antidepressants, but then you also think them weak for drinking alcohol, but then you also have a problem with them refusing to drink alcohol, what can you do right?
But it is sometimes very hard to have willpower if the whole day you're being bombarded by anxious thoughts or panic or depression. And so it's not, I think one should avoid, shaming people who have difficulty staying sober or, not taking these options, because I think what it really, really need is obviously just a much, much more money being invested in helping people with addiction or mental illness generally. Of course, we know that is also a fact.
We know that's a branch that is massively underfunded.
Underfunded,
everywhere,
yes.
Yeah.
And of course, in the end, it is something that people probably have to decide for themselves. But I think supporting people who are struggling with these things is something which one should do more. And that is why I said, from my own experience, I decided that I don't judge people And if I can, I try and support people in the means that are possible. But yeah, I mean, if you yourself are prone to self-medication or you know someone, then there are institutions that you can talk to. There are people you can talk to. Unfortunately, not as many
as there should be.
There's not enough funding. Some countries more than others, obviously, but yeah, don't despair. there are possibilities to find other options. And
and also, like we said, there is no shame in talking to your doctor about. Yeah, don't. I mean, I get it. I understand, and I, you know, don't know where I'm going with this.
I think we've already clocked up enough time for today. But as always, if you have any stories you want to share, or questions or thoughts on this episode, feel free to write to us. And yeah, don't forget to subscribe on Instagram, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, etc.
Oh, have we told them what we're going to do next week?
Ah, no, we haven't. Yeah. So you tell them, Lewis.
Okay. Next week, we're going to be talking about the psychological symptoms of anxiety disorder. So we had a...
And panic disorder.
And panic disorder. We had a episode about the physical symptoms. Yeah. So this one is going to be more about the sort of psychological side of anxiety. So how it manifests itself in the mind, I suppose.
Yeah, in our minds at least.
It. From our perspective.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. As always, feel free to reach out to us on Instagram, in our DMs, or in the comment section. And we will be back again next week.